Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine a US president whose entire time in office lasted, well, less than a single calendar month, like a blink and you miss it presidency.
Right.
Yet his life story, both before and after that incredibly brief time, was just this whirlwind. We're talking military heroism, huge land deals, political maneuvering, stuff that really shaped the nation as it was growing.
Absolutely.
So today we are immersing ourselves doing a deep dive into the extraordinary and extraordinarily brief presidency of William Henry Harrison. Now, if you're someone who maybe wants a shortcut to genuinely understanding some of the complexities of history, or you just love those moments where scattered facts suddenly, click together into a bigger picture.
Moments.
Exactly. Then this deep dive is definitely for you. We're not just rattling off dates and facts here. We're digging through a whole stack of sources to unearth those surprising nuggets, the insights that tell the story of a figure who often gets overlooked, mostly because his time in the White House was so short. But his impact, it resonated for decades across the American landscape.
Yeah, and what's really compelling about Harrison, I think, is that while he definitely holds that record shortest presidency, no question his life offers this incredibly rich, really intricate tapestry of early America.
Right.
You've got the frontier, military strategy, how government worked back then, even how political campaigns started to, evolve.
Yeah.
So our mission today really is to pull out those crucial insights. From the accounts we have, the historical analyses, we want to understand the why behind his big actions and connect his personal journey to that much larger story of American expansion, the development of government.
And also explore the tragic circumstances that cut his term so incredibly short.
Exactly. It's a fascinating mix.
So to guide us, we've gathered quite an array of materials. We have detailed biographical sketches, tracing his family background, pretty aristocratic actually, in his early military days. Then there are accounts of those often pre-controversial land treaties with indigenous peoples. We'll look at the almost theatrical nature of his presidential campaigns. They really did break new ground in American
It
politics.
really did. Very modern in some ways.
And maybe most intriguingly, we'll dig into the medical mystery surrounding his death. There's actually a fresh modern perspective on what might have really happened in the White House back then.
Yeah, that part's fascinating.
So let's dive in. Let's start right at the beginning, looking at the foundations of his life. Okay, so William Henry Harrison, you really have to start at the beginning because his origins, well, they were far from the log cabin image he later became famous for.
Not at all.
He was born February 9th, 1773, at Berkeley Plantation. That's a pretty grand estate in Charles City County, Virginia. And this wasn't just any family. The Harrisons were like a major Virginia dynasty.
Oh, yeah, deep roots,
Yeah.
English descent, been there since the 1630s, really established.
He was the seventh and youngest kid of Benjamin Harrison Val and Elizabeth Bassett Harrison, a family truly woven into the fabric of the colonies.
And his father, Benjamin Harrison, I mean, he was a big deal. A U.S. founding father, delegate to the Continental Congress, actually signed the Declaration of Independence.
Wow.
And he served as Virginia's governor for a time too, from 1781 to 84. So this pretty aristocratic background meant William Henry Harrison was actually the last president born as a British subject in the 13 colonies.
Huh, I never realized that.
Yeah, it really puts his early life into context. It's no wonder he often called himself a child of the Revolution. He grew up just about 30 miles from Yorktown.
Right near the action.
Exactly. His childhood was steeped in the very creation of the American Republic. He was practically a witness to its birth.
It's such a striking contrast, though, isn't it? You've got this guy from basically American royalty. His brother, Carter Bassett Harrison, was in the House of Representatives, too.
Political family
Oh.
through and through.
And yet later on, he's successfully branded as the ultimate log cabin candidate. That just shows you how flexible political stories can be, right? How image could really trump reality, even back then.
Oh, absolutely. The power of narrative. And his early education, it also reflects this kind of privileged but ultimately sort of unconventional path.
How so?
Well, like a lot of kids of his status, he was tutored at home until he was about 14, gave the basics. Then he went off to Hampden-Sydney College, which was Presbyterian, spent 3 years there, got a really rigorous classical education, Latin, Greek, French, logic, debate.
A whole nine yards for a gentleman of the
Pretty
time.
much. Preparing him for public life or maybe intellectual pursuits.
But then his father, who was an Episcopalian, pulled him out.
Yeah, that's the story. possibly over religious differences, the strict Presbyterianism maybe. So after that, he had a couple of short stints in academy in Southampton County, stayed with his older brother Benjamin in Richmond.
Kind of bouncing around a bit.
A little bit. And then eventually he moves to Philadelphia in 1790. And that move, well, that really set the stage for a major shift in his life.
Right, because his father died the next spring, 1791.
Exactly. And William, he's kind of directionless, maybe short on funds. He ends up under the care of Robert Morris, a big name family friend in Philly.
The financier of the revolution, right?
That's the one. And Morris points young Harrison towards medicine. So he starts studying at the University of Pennsylvania with these giants of early American medicine, Dr. Benjamin Rush, another signer of the Declaration,
wow,
and Dr. William Shippen Sr. So it looked like a pretty prestigious path, you know, continuing those hopes for his future.
But it didn't take.
Nope. It seems pretty clear medicine just wasn't his thing. Sources say he just didn't prefer it. Plus, his older brother got most of the inheritance, so Harrison didn't really have the money to keep going with medical school anyway.
Ah, okay.
So he withdrew. Though, fun fact, he's still listed as a non-graduate alumnus of Penn's medical school class of 1793.
Huh. So this raises a really interesting point then. How did this sudden shift, you know, from classics, then medicine, to just jumping into a military career?
Yeah.
How did that shape him as a leader later on, especially dealing with the frontier?
Yeah, that's a great question. It suggests he was pretty adaptable, maybe searching for something that fit his, I don't know, temperament better. It certainly wasn't a planned path. And that jump into the military, it was incredibly sudden, like really sudden. He was directly influenced by his father's friend, Governor Henry Lee III of Virginia, Light Horse Harry Lee.
Okay.
So August 16th, 1791, Harrison is 18 years old. Within 24 hours of meeting Governor Lee, boom, he's commissioned as an ensign in the U.S. Army.
Just like that.
Just like that. No slow ramp up. He's immediately assigned to the 1st American Regiment at Fort Washington, modern-day Cincinnati, right in the middle of the Northwest Territory, and smack dab in the ongoing Northwest Indian War.
Wow, talk about being thrown in the deep end. A real baptism by fire. His biographer, William Freeling, tells this almost unbelievable story.
Oh, the recruiting story.
Yeah. Like, one of his first jobs was recruiting. And he supposedly rounded up 80, quote, thrill seekers and troublemakers off the streets of Philadelphia, convinced them to enlist, and then personally marched them all the way to Fort Washington.
It's incredible. Talk about learning on the job, from med student to recruiting sergeant, practically, then straight into the dangers of the frontier. It's quite the origin story for a president. Really shows he could lead under pressure, even then.
Absolutely. And it seems like his talent for military command was noticed pretty quickly.
Definitely. He rose fast. By 92, he's a lieutenant, serving under Major General Mad Anthony Wayne. Wayne was a really respected officer who took over after some pretty bad defeats for the Americans out there.
Right.
And by 1793, Harrison becomes Wayne's aide-de-camp. That's a key position. Gave him invaluable direct experience in commanding troops on the frontier, learning strategy firsthand from Wayne. He's right there at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, August 20, 1794.
The decisive battle, right. The one that basically ended the Northwest Indian War.
Yeah, it's the one. It secured huge territories for the U.S.
And Harrison did well there.
He did. General Wayne specifically praised his, quote, conduct and bravery for relaying orders across the battlefield, getting troops moving. That's a serious compliment from someone like Wayne.
Definitely. And his involvement wasn't just on the battlefield, right? He was part of the Treaty of Greenville.
He was. He signed it as a witness in 1795. And that treaty was hugely important. It formally handed over a massive chunk of indigenous land to the federal government, basically opened up two-thirds of what's now Ohio to American settlers. It completely changed the map, politically and demographically.
So these early military years were clearly crucial for him, shaped how he saw warfare, but also the whole messy reality of frontier expansion and land deals.
Absolutely foundational. And around this time, 1793, his mother died, and he inherited about 3,000 acres and several enslaved people from the family estate back in Virginia.
Did he keep it?
No, he was still active in the army, so he sold the land to his brother. Maybe suggests his focus was still military, wanted to keep things simple. Kept serving, got promoted to captain in May 1797, but then resigned from the army on June 1st, 1798.
Interesting. After almost 7 years, what prompted that, do we know?
Well, it hints that maybe his ambitions were growing beyond just the military, maybe looking towards civilian life, politics, perhaps.
And before he left the army, he also got married.
Right. Met Anna Tuthill Sims in North Bend, Ohio in 1795. He was 22. And she also came from a pretty notable family. Her father was Judge John Cleve Sims, a Revolutionary War colonel, represented in the Congress of the Confederation.
Okay, so another prominent connection.
Definitely. And their courtship story is kind of legendary.
Oh, how so?
Well, Judge Sims, apparently a pretty stern guy, initially refused to let them marry. Didn't think Harrison, this young officer, had a stable future.
So what did they do?
They eloped. November 25, 1795. Got married in secret at the home of Stephen Wood, the treasurer of the Northwest Territory.
Huh, and the honeymoon.
Get this. Because Harrison still had military duties, they spent their first married days at Fort Washington.
That's dedication. Or maybe just practicality back then. I love the story about Judge Sims confronting Harrison later.
Oh, yeah. Asking how he planned to support a family as just a captain.
And Harrison's reply. By my sword and my own right arm, sir. Classic frontier bravado. It says so much about him.
It really does. But while it sounds romantic, the marriage was also, let's be honest, strategically smart for Harrison. Politically, economically.
How so?
He could tap into his father-in-law's connections. Judge Sims was a major land speculator. That turned out to be crucial when Harrison moved into civilian life.
Right. Even though Sims had his doubts at first, didn't he write something pretty blunt?
He did. Famously wrote to a friend that Harrison can neither bleed, plead, nor preach, and if he could plow, I should be satisfied.
Ouch. That really shows the practical concerns back then, doesn't it? Military glory was nice, but could you actually provide?
Exactly. But Sims eventually came around. He sold the couple 160 acres in North Bend, and that's where Harrison built their home, Grouseland, and started a farm.
And Anna, she seems like she was pretty tough herself.
Incredibly resilient. They had 10 children, which took a toll on her health. Apparently, she was often unwell. But she outlived William by 23 years, died at 88 in 1864.
Wow. And one of their kids, John Scott Harrison.
Right. He became the father of future President Benjamin Harrison, making William Henry and Benjamin the only grandfather-grandson pair of presidents. It's a neat bit of historical trivia.
So looking at this whole period, his marriage, the land, deals, it really highlights how things worked on the frontier, right? Social status, military service, money, land, it was all connected.
Absolutely. His marriage was a strategic alliance combined with his military rep and access to land. It gave him a clear path upwards. And Judge Sims' initial reaction, focusing on practical skills, tells you a lot about the values of the time.
Now, there's another layer here, a much more complex and contested one, regarding his personal life.
Ah, yes. The claim about Andea.
Right. Professor Kenneth Jenkin mentions this, based on oral history. The claim is that Harrison fathered 6 children with an enslaved African-American woman named Dilcia, and that before running for president, he supposedly gave 4 of those children to his brother to avoid scandal. Gail Collins, in her biography, calls it an unlikely story.
Right. It's definitely contested and relies on oral tradition, which can be hard to verify definitively.
But the fact that the story exists, and given the historical context of power dynamics and slavery, it certainly points to the often hidden, deeply complex, and morally challenging aspects of private lives back then, especially involving enslaved people. Whether it's true or not, it reminds us of those complexities.
It absolutely does. It's a stark reminder of the human realities intertwined with the institution of slavery.
Okay, so Harrison leaves the military, settles down, starts a family. But he wasn't done with public life. Not by a long shot.
No, he pivoted pretty quickly into civilian government. After resigning from the army in June 98, he immediately started using his connections, friends, family lobbying for a post in the Northwest Territorial Government.
And it worked.
It did. With help from his friend Timothy Pickering, who was Secretary of State, and definitely his father-in-law Judge Sims' influence, President John Adams appointed him Secretary of the Northwest Territory in July 1798.
What did that job involve?
Mostly bureaucratic stuff, recording the territory's official acts. And apparently, Harrison found it pretty tedious.
Didn't suit him.
Seems not. He quickly expressed a desire for something more active, more influential, like a seat in the U.S. Congress. It points to that restless ambition again, right? Wanting to make policy, not just shuffle papers.
So, battlefield, medical studies, paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
He's still searching for the right fit, a drive for direct engagement.
Definitely. And he found that next step pretty fast. Harrison had been smart, cultivating friendships with the Eastern elite, using those connections. But crucially, he also built a strong reputation out west as a capable frontier leader. He even ran a successful horse breeding business that got him noticed.
But what really made him popular?
His push for lower land costs for settlers. That was a huge issue for people flooding into the territory. He championed their cause.
And that led to Congress.
Yep. By October 1799, the Northwest Territory had grown enough to get a delegate in Congress. Harrison jumped at the chance, got elected as the territory's first congressional delegate in 1798. He was only 26.
That's young.
Very. He served it from March 99 to May 1800. Now, as a delegate, he couldn't vote on final bills. That power was limited. But he could serve on committees, submit legislation, debate. It gave him a really powerful platform.
And he made good use of it.
Remarkably so, especially for such a short time. He quickly became chairman of the Committee on Public Lands, a key spot given all the expansion. And in that role, he was absolutely instrumental in pushing through the Land Act of 1800.
What'd that do?
It made it much easier for ordinary folks to buy land in the Northwest Territory. Smaller plots, lower cost, and crucially, only a 5% down payment.
Wow, that must have fueled settlement.
Massively. It was a catalyst for rapid population growth, really fed into that American dream of owning land.
And he was involved in splitting up the territory too, right?
He was. He played a key role in dividing that huge Northwest Territory. The eastern part stayed the Northwest Territory, basically Ohio and eastern Michigan. The much bigger western part became the Indiana Territory, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, parts of Michigan and Minnesota.
Setting the stage for future states?
Exactly. Those two new territories were legally set up in 1800. It was a major administrative and political move.
What's really striking here is how smoothly he went from war hero to, well, an effective politician and administrator. The Land Act, dividing the territory. These weren't just small things.
Not at all. They were foundational acts, genuinely laying the groundwork for statehood, for westward expansion. It shows he had real legislative skill and understood regional development early on.
And President Adams clearly saw that potential.
He did. Building on that success, on May 13, 1800, Adams gave Harrison a huge appointment. First governor of the brand new Indiana Territory.
A job he held for a long time.
12 years. Confirmed by the Senate, took office in Vincennes, the capital, in 1801.
And he kept getting reappointed, even when presidents changed. Adams was a Federalist. Jefferson and Madison were Democratic Republicans.
Right. He got reappointed in 1803, 1806, and 1809. It really shows how effective, or at least how indispensable, he was seen on the frontier, regardless of party politics in Washington. He even briefly ran the civilian government for the District of Louisiana for a few weeks in 1804.
And back in Indiana, he built his home, Grouseland.
Yep. That grand 26-room plantation-style house near Vincennes became the social and political hub of the territory. He was also involved in founding what became Vincennes University in 1801. Showed a commitment to education, too.
Now let's talk about a major and really controversial part of his governorship.
Yeah.
The land treaties. His main job was acquiring title to Indian lands, wasn't it?
That was the primary responsibility, yes. It wasn't just a task, it was the central mandate. Crucial for allowing American settlement, boosting the population, both needed for Indiana to eventually become a state.
And Harrison had personal interests tied up in this too, right? His own political future, his land holdings.
Absolutely. While he got credit for being a good administrator, improving roads and infrastructure, he also personally benefited from land speculation. He bought two milling operations himself. Then in 1803, President Jefferson gave him expanded power to negotiate treaties with the tribes.
And his approach was aggressive.
Undeniably aggressive. Yeah. He often offered large subsidies to tribes and their leaders, basically incentives to get them to sign away land to the federal government.
This is where things get really difficult and dark looking back. The 1804 Treaty of St. Louis, for example.
Right, that forced the Sauk and Meskwaki tribes to give up huge areas in western Illinois and parts of Missouri. It was deeply resented, especially by Black Hawk. His later resistance was directly linked back to that treaty.
And even when treaties were signed, like the 1805 Treaty of Grouseland, tensions didn't just disappear.
No, they simmered. Then came the 1809 Treaty of Fort Wayne. Harrison bought over 2.5 million acres from the Potawatomi, Delaware, Miami, and Eel River tribes.
That must have been hugely controversial.
It was, even then. Many other indigenous leaders argued that the specific tribes involved didn't have the right to sell land that was traditionally held communally or belonged to a larger confederation.
It's just a stark reminder of the often brutal reality of American expansion and the devastating impact on indigenous communities. That quote from biographer William Freeling is chilling.
The one about acquiring 51 million acres in 1805.
Yeah. Two-thirds of Illinois, chunks of Wisconsin and Missouri, after plying five of their chiefs with alcohol for no more than a dollar per 20,000 acres. Whether perfectly accurate or not, it paints this picture of a, quote, shady treaty maker.
It underscores the aggressive, sometimes coercive tactics used. These weren't just land deals. They were strategic moves that dispossessed people from their ancestral lands, leading to generations of conflict.
And besides the land issue, Harrison's stance on slavery in Indiana was another major point of contention.
Yes, very much so. His pro-slavery position made him really unpopular with abolitionists. In 1803, he actively lobbied Congress to suspend Article 6 of the Northwest Ordinance for 10 years.
Article 6 being the part that prohibited slavery in the territory.
Exactly. Harrison argued suspending it was necessary for settlement, for economic viability, to eventually get statehood. He basically thought slavery was essential for the economy, but Congress didn't go for it. The proposal failed.
But he found other ways.
He and the territorial legislature did. In 1807, with his support, they passed laws authorizing indentured servitude. These laws gave masters huge power, often for life, over the service of black individuals.
So, basically, slavery by another name.
Pretty much. A way to get around the ordinance's prohibition.
This really highlights the complexities, the contradictions of early America. Here's a future president, a national hero later on, pushing policies that seem completely at odds with the nation's ideals.
It's a powerful reminder that historical figures are rarely simple. They're products of their time, operating within existing structures, often holding contradictory views. And the fight over slavery wasn't just a later Civil War thing. It was right there, being fought over in the territories from the beginning.
Didn't Jefferson actually work against Harrison on this?
Secretly, yes. Jefferson, who drafted the Northwest Ordinance, quietly supported an abolitionist named James Lemon, even gave him money to tricky defeat Harrison's pro-slavery efforts in Indiana. And eventually, the abolitionists gained ground. In the 1809 elections, they got more power in the legislature.
And they repealed those indentured servitude laws.
They did in 1810. It was a significant, though maybe temporary, setback for the expansion of slavery in that territory.
So all these tensions over land, over slavery, they eventually boiled over into open conflict, which brings us to a really defining moment for Harrison, Tecumseh's War.
Right. Indigenous resistance to American expansion really peaked under the leadership of the Shawnee brothers, Tecumseh and Tenskwatawa.
Tenskwatawa was the prophet, right?
Yes. He preached this powerful message, rejecting white ways, returning to traditional practices, and claiming spiritual protection against the settlers. It was a very nativist revitalization movement.
And Harrison knew this was brewing.
Oh, yeah. He had spies among the tribes. He knew about the growing resistance. He kept asking President Madison for military funding, seeing the potential for a major conflict. Madison was hesitant at first, though.
So Harrison tried negotiating.
He did, but it was more like an attempted intimidation. He sent a letter to Tecumseh, basically bragging about American military might. That famous line, "Our blue coats are more numerous than you can count, and our hunting shirts are like the leaves of the forests."
Trying to scare him off? Did it work?
Not on Tecumseh. In August 1810, Tecumseh leads 400 warriors down the Wabash to meet Harrison in Vincennes. They arrive in full war paint, apparently really unnerved the American soldiers.
Wow. And the meeting itself?
Explosive. Held at Grouseland, Harrison's home, Tecumseh just lays into Harrison, calls the Fort Wayne Treaty illegitimate, says no single tribe can sell land that belongs to everyone without agreement, demands it be nullified, warns against more settlement.
He didn't hold back.
Not at all. He even told Harrison he'd threatened to kill the chiefs who had signed the treaty if they followed through. And he talked about this growing pan-Indian confederation aiming to resist the Americans everywhere.
How did Harrison respond?
He stuck to his guns. Argued tribes did own their land individually and could sell it. Rejected the whole idea of one Indian nation. Even made that comment about the Great Spirit giving them one language if they were meant to be one nation. A real clash of worldviews.
That confrontation sounds absolutely intense. The sources describe Tecumseh getting really passionate, shouting, calling Harrison a liar.
Right. And apparently some of his warriors started grabbing their weapons. It got very tense. Harrison drew his sword. His officers raised their guns.
A standoff?
Pretty much. It was actually Chief Winnemac, an indigenous leader friendly to Harrison, who helped calm things down, got the warriors to back off. But before Tecumseh left, he gave that stark warning. Nullify the treaty, or he'd ally with the British.
A threat that would become reality.
Indeed. And Harrison was genuinely worried. He feared Tecumseh's Confederacy would block Indiana's path to statehood. Leave it, as he put it, the haunt of a few wretched savages.
So when Tecumseh was away in 1811, trying to recruit more tribes,
Harrison saw his chance. Even though he'd been out of military command for 13 years, he convinced Madison and the Secretary of War, William Eustis, to let him lead an expedition. He marched north with about 950 men to basically intimidate the Shawnee at Prophetstown.
But they weren't intimidated.
No. The tribes launched a surprise attack early on November 7th, 1811, the Battle of Tippecanoe.
How did it go?
Harrison's forces took significant losses, 62 dead, 126 wounded. The Shawnee probably lost around 150. But Harrison's troops held their ground and ultimately defeated the tribal forces, destroying Prophetstown.
And the impact?
Huge. It shattered Tenskwatawa's spiritual authority, his claim of protection, and Harrison was instantly hailed as a national hero. That's where he got the nickname Old Tippecanoe.
A name that would follow him forever.
Absolutely. It became central to his political identity. It's also interesting that the first news reports were confused. Some even called it a defeat for Harrison. But once the story got straight, the victory celebrations began.
Looking at the bigger picture, Tippecanoe was really pivotal, wasn't it? Not just for Harrison's fame.
Definitely pivotal. It seriously weakened that Pan-Indian resistance movement, disrupted its leadership, made it easier for American settlers to push further into the Ohio Valley.
And it fueled anti-British sentiment.
Massively. It fed right into the narrative that the British were arming the tribes, inciting violence. This became a key factor pushing the U.S. towards the War of 1812. Public anger really ramped up.
And when war was declared, June 18, 1812, Harrison jumped back in.
He actively sought a command, served briefly as a major general in the Kentucky militia, then got a federal commission on September 17th to lead the Army of the Northwest.
And there was that controversy about him collecting two salaries for a while.
Yeah, his military pay and his governor's salary. He didn't formally resign as governor until December 28th. Mm. Some accounts say the administration basically forced him to choose.
How did he do in the War of 1812 itself?
He really proved himself again. After some early American setbacks, like the loss of Detroit, President Madison put Harrison in charge. He built strong defenses over the winter at Fort Meigs in Ohio. Then, with reinforcements, he went on the offensive.
Recaptured Detroit.
Yep, a big strategic and morale boost. Then he pushed into Upper Canada, what's now Ontario.
Leading to another major victory.
The Battle of the Thames, October 5, 1813. Harrison's army decisively beat the British and their indigenous allies. And, crucially, Tecumseh was killed in this battle.
Wow. That must have been a huge blow to the resistance.
Devastating. Remove their most charismatic leader. The Battle of the Thames was celebrated as one of the greatest American victories of the war, maybe second only to New Orleans later on. It cemented Harrison's national reputation as a top military hero.
But despite all that success, he resigned from the army again in May 1814.
He did. Seems it was due to major disagreements with the Secretary of War, John Armstrong, over strategy, particularly about continuing the invasion of Canada. The relationship just broke down.
That hurt his reputation.
Not in the long run. After the war, Congress actually investigated the whole thing and concluded Armstrong had mistreated Harrison. They even awarded Harrison a gold medal for his service in the war. Clear vindication.
And he was involved in yet another treaty afterwards.
Yes. The Treaty of Springwells in 1815 negotiated with Lewis Cass, the governor of Michigan Territory. And, consistent with his past actions, it ceded yet more Indian lands for American settlement.
So the war hero returns home. After all the victories, the national fame, Harrison goes back to his farm in North Bend, Ohio in 1814. But it wasn't exactly a quiet retirement, was it?
Not really. He actually found himself in pretty rough financial shape, deeply in debt. Apparently, his expenses always outran his income. Biographer Freeling has that interesting observation that Harrison maybe chose celebrity over duty, always seeking the limelight, and became an office seeker partly out of financial necessity.
Needing the income and the status.
Exactly. Those financial struggles really pushed him back into politics almost immediately. He gets elected to the U.S. House for Ohio's 1st District in 1816, serves until 1819.
But he was aiming higher.
Seems so. He tried but failed to get appointed Secretary of War under President Monroe in 1817. Also got passed over for a diplomatic post to Russia. He was definitely actively looking for a significant government role.
He was really hustling, politically speaking. The record shows him bouncing around different offices. Ohio Senate from 1819 to 21.
Mm-hmm. Then he lost a race for Ohio governor in 1820, lost another U.S. House election in 1822. It wasn't an easy path.
Before finally getting elected to the U.S. Senate in 1824, it's such a human story, isn't it? Even a famous war hero dealing with money problems, trying to find his place after a big career shift. Fame didn't automatically mean an easy life.
Not at all in the early republic. Mm-hmm. And his career took another really fascinating turn in 1828. He gets appointed Minister Plenipotentiary to Gran Colombia.
So diplomat Harrison, he had to resign from the Senate for that.
Yes. He arrived in Bogota in December 1828. And what he found was a country, in his view, on the edge of anarchy. Simón Bolívar, the great liberator, was looking more and more like he might become a military dictator.
And Harrison, the staunch Republican, didn't approve.
Not one bit. He famously wrote this letter to Bolívar, a sort of polite rebuke, arguing that the strongest of all governments is that which is most free. He basically urged Bolívar to stick with democracy, resist the lure of absolute power.
That's pretty bold for a diplomat, directly challenging the leader of the country you're posted in.
Extremely bold. And Bolívar's response is equally famous, especially in Latin America. He shot back that the U.S. seemed destined by providence to plague America with torments in the name of freedom.
Wow, quite a statement. So Harrison's time there was difficult.
Very. Freeling argues Harrison made bad and frequent missteps, didn't stay neutral, openly opposed Bolívar, and eventually Gran Colombia asked for him to be removed. President Andrew Jackson recalled him in March 1829, a short and controversial diplomatic stint.
But other biographers see it differently.
Some do. Hall and Burr, for instance, describe him finding a military despotism. They felt his liberal opinions and simple Republican style clashed too much with the arbitrary opinions of the officials there, making his position impossible. And that long letter he wrote to Bolívar, it was praised back in the U.S. as being full of wisdom, goodness, and patriotism. So perceptions really varied.
Interesting. What does that whole episode tell us about Harrison?
Well, it definitely highlights his strong Republican beliefs, his willingness to challenge authority, even if it wasn't diplomatically wise. It also gives us a window into those early tricky relationships between the U.S. and the new Latin American nations, where ideas about freedom and government were still very much in flux.
So after being recalled, he goes back to the farm again.
Back to North Bend. Enters a period of, quote, relative privacy after nearly 40 years of government or military service. But he hadn't gotten rich. He lived on savings, a small pension, farm income.
There's that description from the French Observer, Amicia Chevalier.
Right. Describing Harrison as poor with a numerous family, abandoned by the federal government, yet vigorous with independent thinking. A really striking image of this former national figure struggling financially.
And then he takes on a local job.
Yeah, this is fascinating. His local supporters, seeing his struggles, appointed him clerk of courts for Hamilton County, a relatively minor post he held from 1836 to 1840.
And Chevalier made that ironic comment.
That his friends back east talk of making him president, while here we make him clerk of an inferior court. It just perfectly captures the contrast between his national image and his local reality then. Shows how precarious things could be.
This period also seems to show a real shift, or maybe deepening, of his personal values. He started a distillery.
He did. Grew corn, made whiskey, but then he shut it down. Became really disturbed by the effects of alcohol. He even publicly addressed the local agricultural board in 1831, said he'd sinned by making whiskey, hoped others would learn from his mistake.
That takes some conviction. And his views on slavery seem to evolve, too. He befriended George de Baptiste.
An abolitionist, a conductor on the Underground Railroad. Harrison wrote that we might look forward to a day when a North American son would not look down upon a slave. It's a powerful statement. And de Baptiste later became his valet, even his White House steward.
That's incredible. So the war hero, governor, diplomat, ends up a county clerk and farmer who closes his distillery on moral grounds and seems to be rethinking slavery, at least personally.
It's an amazing arc.
Mm-hmm.
Shows ambition, yes, but also maybe a surprising humility, a shift in values later in life. It really sets the stage for the kind of president he might become, someone with elite roots, but maybe a newfound connection to more common concerns. And that ability to connect, or at least project a connection, with the common man became absolutely central to his presidential runs. Let's look at 1836 first.
Okay.
Harrison emerges as one of four regional Whig candidates.
Yeah.
Yeah, Daniel Webster, Hugh L. White, Willie P. Mangum. The Whigs were still pretty new, formed to oppose Andrew Jackson's Democrats. And they tried this unusual strategy.
Running multiple guys in different regions.
Exactly. The hope was to prevent Jackson's chosen successor, Martin Van Buren, from getting a clear majority in the Electoral College. If they could do that, the election would go to the House of Representatives,
mm-hmm.
where the Whigs thought they might have a chance.
Clever idea. Did it work?
Not quite.
Mm-hmm.
Van Buren still won with 170 electoral votes. But Harrison actually came in second overall, carried 9 states. And it's closer than you might think. If just over 4,000 votes had flipped in Pennsylvania.
They would have gone to the House.
Exactly. Pennsylvania's 30 electoral votes would have gone to Harrison, denying Van Buren the majority. So even with a split ticket and a new party, Harrison showed he had real pull as a candidate.
So that 1836 election, it really shows the early days of the second party system, right? The Whigs trying to figure out how to beat the Jacksonian machine.
Absolutely. It's a snapshot of evolving American politics. Parties were still experimenting with how to mobilize voters nationally. And Harrison's strong showing clearly marked him as someone to watch for the future.
So fast forward to 1840. The Whigs have learned a few things.
They have. This time, Harrison is their sole candidate against the incumbent, Van Buren. And the Whigs were smart. They saw Harrison's unique appeal. Southern-born, war hero. A deliberate contrast to Van Buren, who they relentlessly painted as aloof, uncaring, aristocratic.
They picked him over bigger Whig names like Clay and Webster.
They did. Clay and Webster were more established, but also more controversial, maybe seen as too elite themselves. Harrison had broader, more populist potential.
And the campaign itself, it was something else.
A masterclass in early political branding. They hammered on Harrison's military record. Old Tippecanoe was everywhere. And crucially, they exploited the weak economy, the fallout from the Panic of 1837.
Blaming Van Buren, Van Ruin.
Exactly. Tied the nation's economic pain directly to the guy in charge. Very effective.
The Democrats tried to hit back, right? By mocking Harrison.
They did. Called him Granny Harrison, the petticoat general, because he'd resigned from the army. Pointed out his name spelled backward was No-Sirrah. Tried to paint him as this provincial, out-of-touch old man who'd rather just sit in his log cabin drinking hard cider than run the country.
Trying to make him seem too simple, too rustic.
Yeah, but it backfired. Big time.
How so?
In a stroke of genius, Harrison and his running mate John Tyler just embraced the insults, the log cabin. Hard cider. They made them the symbols of the campaign.
Turned the negative into a positive.
Completely. Put them on banners, posters, pamphlets. They even made little log cabin-shaped bottles of hard cider. It was all about connecting Harrison to the common man. Pure marketing brilliance.
It really was. That quote Freeling uses from the pro-Van Buren paper after the election is perfect. We have been sung down, lied down, and drunk down.
Sums it up perfectly, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Describes this new American political process. Harrison, from this wealthy, slaveholding Virginia family, gets successfully repackaged as a humble frontiersman, like Andrew Jackson, while Van Buren, who came from more modest roots, gets painted as the snooty elitist.
Total inversion of reality. And they had specific attacks, too, like the gold spoon oration.
Oh, yeah. Whig Congressman Charles Ogle just ripped into Van Buren's White House lifestyle, the fancy furnishings, contrasting it with Harrison's supposed simple life. And they had that catchy chant.
The wort wort one.
That's it. Old tip. He wore a homespun coat. He had no ruffled shirt. Wort wort. But Matt, he has the golden plate, and he's a little squirt. Wort wort. And people would actually spit tobacco juice on the wort wort. Really playing up that rough common man image.
It's absolutely fascinating. The 1840 campaign feels like the blueprint for so much modern political branding and mudslinging. The symbols, the slogan, Tippecanoe and Tyler too, Harrison actually campaigning actively.
Entertaining crowds with Indian war whoops, diverting attention from the economy. It was all there. That rally at Tippecanoe drew 60,000 people. Unheard of back then. Showed the power of these mass events. Even Ohio's nickname, Buckeyes, might trace back to Harrison's campaign using buckeye leaves as symbols.
So this election really marks a huge shift, doesn't it? Towards populist messaging, engaging voters directly, not just relying on party bosses.
A massive shift. It showed the growing power of public image, of simple, relatable stories, even if they stretch the truth. It was also maybe the first election with an October surprise.
Oh, yeah. What was that?
Just days before the vote, Van Buren's Justice Department accused the Whigs of stupendous and atrocious fraud in a Pennsylvania election 2 years earlier, a last-ditch effort to swing voters.
Did it work?
Didn't seem to matter much in the end. Voter turnout exploded, hit 80%, up 20 points from the last election. People were engaged.
And Harrison won big.
Landslide in the Electoral College, 234-60 for Van Buren. The popular vote was closer, less than 150,000 votes difference, but he carried 19 out of 26 states. A decisive victory, driven by a whole new way of doing politics. So Harrison wins this landmark election. He arrives in Washington, and apparently he's determined to show everyone he's not just the backwoods caricature his campaign created. He wants to be seen as serious, educated, thoughtful.
Ready to govern.
Exactly. So Inauguration Day, Thursday, March 4th, 1841. It's a really cold, wet day.
And Harrison famously braved the weather.
He did. No overcoat, no hat. Rode on horseback to the ceremony. It was partly a show of vigor, maybe still playing that common man role a bit, defying the elements.
And then came the speech, the long speech.
Oh, the longest inaugural address ever, 8,445 words. Took him nearly 2 hours to read. And that was after Daniel Webster supposedly edited it down.
Wow. He was making a statement. I'm not just old Tippecanoe.
Precisely. Though Freeling points out the irony. Here's this lifelong office seeker elected through intense partisan politics, now using his speech to criticize both practices. A fascinating contradiction.
What was actually in the speech? What was his vision?
Well, it was really his only chance to lay out his approach, the Whig agenda. It was a clear rejection of Jackson and Van Buren. He talked about trusting in almighty power.
And specific policies.
He promised to reestablish the Bank of the United States, expand credit with paper money, that's pure Henry Clay, the American system. He also said he'd defer to Congress on laws, only use the veto if something was unconstitutional.
Reversing the spoils system, too.
Yes, promised qualified staff, not political rewards. And interestingly, he declared he wouldn't run for a second term, maybe to ease fears about executive power.
So very much a Whig platform, limiting the president's power compared to Jackson.
Absolutely. Condemned the previous administration's spending, pledged not to mess with Congress's financial policy. He explicitly committed to a weak presidency, deferring to Congress as the first branch. That was core Whig ideology.
Did he address slavery?
He did. As a slaveholder himself, he sided with states' rights. Warned against one state trying to control another's domestic institutions, saying it would lead to disunion, violence, and civil war. A pretty stark warning.
And he mentioned religion.
Stressed reverence for Christianity. Linked morals and religious liberty to national happiness. Overall, the speech was maybe a bit vague on specifics, but the themes were clear. Limited presidency, deference to Congress, avoid stirring up trouble over slavery or tariffs.
You can almost hear him saying, stick to the Constitution, that's all I ask. After that marathon speech, his day wasn't over, though.
Not even close. Rode in the parade, stood in a receiving line at the White House for 3 hours, then attended three inaugural balls, including the big Tippecanoe Ball with 1,000 guests.
That sounds absolutely exhausting for anyone, let alone a 68-year-old man. Must have taken a toll.
You have to think so. And his presidency, short as it was, immediately ran into big challenges, especially over patronage who gets the government jobs.
The spoil system he promised to end. Enter Henry Clay.
Exactly. Clay, the powerful Whig leader, expected to basically run the show, dictate appointments. He conveniently forgot the party platform against the spoil system when it suited him.
How did Harrison react?
He stood up to him, famously told Clay, Mr. Clay, you forget that I am the president.
Ooh, burn.
Pretty much. And Harrison then appointed Daniel Webster, Clay's main rival as Secretary of State, gave Webster's guys lots of jobs. The only bone he threw Clay was appointing Clay's ally, John J. Crittenden, as Attorney General. Showed Harrison wasn't going to be pushed around, even by Clay.
But he still faced pressure from job seekers.
Oh, massively. Yeah. The White House was apparently overrun. Harrison had delayed appointments until after the inauguration, so everyone showed up at once. The place was just mobbed.
He wrote that letter complaining about it.
March 10th. I am so much harassed by the multitude that calls upon me that I can give no proper attention to any business of my own. There are these crazy stories.
Like people stuffing petitions in his pockets.
Yeah, Alexander Hunter recalled that. And that other story, maybe exaggerated, about him having to climb out a window and walk around outside just to get from room to room because the halls were so packed.
Wow. It highlights a real problem back then, doesn't it? Even if you wanted to reform patronage, the sheer demand was overwhelming.
Exactly. The ideal versus the reality. But Harrison did seem to take his reform pledge seriously. He visited all the cabinet departments, issued an order through Webster saying any employee caught electioneering would be fired. He even pushed back against purely partisan demands.
Like when that group wanted all the Democrats fired.
Right. He supposedly proclaimed, so help me God, I will resign my office before I can be guilty of such an iniquity. And he stood up to his own cabinet when they tried to overrule his choice for governor of Iowa Territory, John Chambers.
What did he say?
Declared, William Henry Harrison, President of the United States, tells you, gentlemen, that by God, John Chambers shall be governor of Iowa. Pretty forceful.
So, despite the chaos, he was trying to assert control. Did he make any major policy decisions in that month?
Only one of real consequence. Calling Congress into a special session. Clay wanted it. Harrison initially didn't. The cabinet was split.
What changed his mind?
The Treasury Secretary, Thomas Ewing, reported the government was basically broke. Couldn't operate until Congress met again regularly in December. So Harrison had no choice, really. He proclaimed the special session for May 31st.
Driven by necessity, but he wouldn't live to see it convene.
Tragically, no, Events were already in motion that would cut his presidency incredibly short.
It sounds like Harrison was just physically worn out. The constant job seekers, the social demands.
He was exhausted, and he kept ignoring the cold weather, going out without proper clothes. That certainly couldn't have helped his immune system. Remember the inauguration? 2 hours in the cold rain without a coat.
Right. And he kept doing it.
Yeah. Apparently. Wednesday, March 24th, just 3 weeks in, takes his usual morning walk to the markets. Again, no coat or hat. Gets caught in a sudden downpour, comes back, doesn't change his wet clothes.
Oh.
Things went downhill fast. Friday the 26th, he feels sick, cold symptoms. Sends for Dr. Thomas Miller. Gets some medicine, feels a bit better initially.
But it didn't last.
No. Saturday, he's worse, back in bed with a severe chill after another morning walk. Miller tries a mustard plaster, laxatives. Then, early Sunday morning, March 28th, severe pain in his side.
Pneumonia.
That's what Miller diagnosed after trying bloodletting, which he had to stop because Harrison's pulse dropped and heated cups.
Right lung pneumonia.
What did they do then?
A team of doctors confirmed it Monday. They basically threw the medical book of the time at him. Laudanum, opium, camphor, wine, brandy. Standard treatments then, but probably not very effective.
And the public didn't really know how serious it was. Not clearly. No official announcements, just rumors, conflicting newspaper reports. People noticed he missed church. His cabinet and family were called to his bedside, but his wife Anna was still back in Ohio, packing to move to Washington. She likely had no idea how bad it was.
So sad. And his condition kept getting worse.
Yes. Saturday evening, April 3rd, he developed severe diarrhea that turns out to be a key symptom and became delirious. Around 8:30 that night, he spoke his last words, apparently to his doctor, but likely meant for Vice President Tyler.
Sir, I wish you to understand the true principles of the government.
I wish them carried out. I ask nothing more. A final plea for his vision of governance.
And then he died.
Just after midnight, 12:30 a.m., April 4th, 1841, Palm Sunday. Exactly 1 month after taking office, 9 days after falling ill, the first president to die in office. A huge shock to the nation.
Now, this is where the story gets that modern twist. For years, everyone believed the story. He caught a cold at the inauguration. It turned into pneumonia, killed him. A romantic, tragic tale.
Right, the story of commitment leading to death. But that 2014 medical analysis by McHugh and McCowiak offers a really different perspective.
Based on the doctor's notes and the White House water supply.
Exactly. They looked closely at the symptoms, especially that severe diarrhea late in the illness, which isn't typical of simple pneumonia. And they considered that the White House water back then was sourced downstream from public sewage.
Oh, dear. Typhoid.
Their conclusion. Likely septic shock caused by enteric fever. Probably typhoid or paratyphoid fever. Contracted from contaminated water or food, not just a cold caught in the rain.
That's a huge aha moment. Yeah. Shatters the old myth with a much more, well, grim and pragmatic reality of sanitation back then.
It really does.
Yeah.
A compelling piece of medical detective work. His death led to this unprecedented 30-day national mourning period. Big public ceremonies modeled on European royal funerals.
The funeral was at the White House.
Invitation only. April 7th, East Room. Then his coffin went to the Congressional Cemetery Vault. Solomon Northup, of 12 years a slave fame, actually wrote about the procession in D.C. The cannons, the tolling bells, the houses draped in black. He captured that sense of public grief.
And then his body was taken back to Ohio.
That June. By train, then river barge, to North Bend. Reburied July 7th on Mount Nebo, now the Harrison Tomb State Memorial. But beyond the mourning, his death immediately created a huge problem.
The succession crisis. First time ever.
Exactly. Fletcher Webster rushed to tell Vice President John Tyler on April 5th. Tyler got back to Washington on the 6th. And suddenly, this ambiguity in the Constitution, Article 2, Section 1, Clause 6, became critical.
The part about what happens if the president dies.
Right. It says the same shall devolve on the vice president. But what did the same mean? Did the VP become president? Or just assume the powers and duties while staying VP? Nobody for sure.
And Harrison's cabinet had their own interpretation.
They did. They wanted Tyler to just be vice president, acting as president. Basically a temp, preserving their own power.
But Tyler wasn't having it.
Not at all. He was resolute, rejected the acting role, claimed the full title, full powers. He wasn't going to be a placeholder.
And his firmness set the precedent.
Absolutely crucial. The cabinet consulted Chief Justice Taney, eventually decided if Tyler took the presidential oath, he was president. Tyler took the oath on April 6th. Congress debated it briefly, but then passed a joint resolution on May 31st, confirming Tyler as president for the rest of Harrison's term.
So Harrison's death, completely unintentionally, solved this huge constitutional question.
Precisely. The Tyler precedent was established. It defined presidential succession peacefully for over a century, used 7 more times, until it was formally written into the Constitution with the 25th Amendment in 1967. It's a massive, enduring legacy from a tragic event.
Incredible. What else should we remember as Harrison's lasting legacy? Those Indian treaties, obviously.
Definitely. Ceding millions of acres during his time as Indiana governor fundamentally shaped the Midwest. Mm. And his campaign methods, they really did lay the groundwork for modern presidential politics, the populist appeals, the branding.
And his financial situation. He died broke.
Pretty much penniless. Congress actually took the step of loading his widow, Anna, a pension, $25,000, his annual salary, which is like $762,000 today, plus free mail privileges.
A few other distinctions, too. Oldest president until Reagan.
Yep. Took office at 68. And the grandfather-grandchild presidential pair with Benjamin Harrison. Though, because his term was so short, William Henry Harrison often gets left out of presidential rankings.
But Freeling called him the most dominant figure in the evolution of the Northwest Territories into the Upper Midwest.
He did, highlighting that his impact, especially in shaping that region, was immense, even if his presidency itself was a footnote in terms of time.
So summing it all up, here's this president most people barely remember, yet his story intersects with so many crucial themes. Westward expansion, indigenous relations, the birth of modern politics, even a major constitutional crisis. His impact, short-term or not, feels undeniable. #outro. So we've really seen how William Henry Harrison was so much more than just, you know, the guy with the shortest presidency. He was this child of the revolution from an elite background who became a frontier soldier, a governor.
Navigating those really complex, often violent relationships with indigenous peoples, using both diplomacy and force to expand the U.S.
Right. And then he pioneers modern campaigning, connecting with the common man despite his own aristocratic roots. It was revolutionary stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then his sudden death, by pure chance, triggers this constitutional moment that profoundly reshapes the presidency itself for over 100 years.
His whole story, it just brilliantly illustrates how quickly things could change in early America, right? From privilege to the frontier, political office to financial struggles, and back to the very top.
It really does. And it's such a powerful reminder that historical figures are, you know, products of their time. They're full of contradictions. Their legacies, even the ones cut short, like Harrison's, can have these huge, unforeseen consequences for how the country works.
Yeah, his story really highlights how ideas about leadership, public service, even democracy itself were still evolving back then.
Mm-hmm. Constantly changing.
And thinking about how his brief term accidentally cleared up the whole succession issue and how his campaign just dramatically changed political advertising. It really makes you wonder, doesn't it?
I bet.
Well, what other seemingly small events or maybe tragic ones in history might have unintentionally set these major long-lasting precedents simply because they forced people to confront a question that hadn't really been answered before?
That's a fascinating thought. How unexpected moments can force clarity or create entirely new paths. Definitely something to chew on.